Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of the Psychosocial Distancing Podcast. I'm one of your hosts, Daniel Chadbourn, and with me, as always, is Thomas Brooks.
Hello, hello.
And joining us today with our continuing discussion of conspiracy theories in psychology and cross-disciplinary fields is Dr. Sinan Alper.
Hi, thank you for inviting me. I'm very glad to be here.
And we're very excited for you to join us. We've had a great group of guests and kind of continuing along with that, with this fascinating research that's going on in the field, especially within the kind of the realm of understanding conspiracy theories. So we've been talking about a number of different perspectives. We've talked about this kind of from psychological perspective of kind of what makes conspiracy theorists tick. We've talked about this in regards to political science and history, and really I'm excited to kind of deep dive into your research, because we're kind of getting into more of the belief structures and also it seems as sort of how the environment or kind of the social systems in which we exist in, particularly the countries that we live in, may change those aspects. And so I guess before we start, because I can never stick the landing on introductions, we'll start like letting you tell us a little bit about yourself and our listeners a little bit about who you are, where you're from, and what kind of got you into this research.
Okay, so I'm from Turkey, first of all. I'm a social psychologist, and I have done my PhD in actually kind of a slightly different area of research. It was about how the perceiving life as random, like events in your life happening randomly, affect people, and how that effect is moderated by people's personality, how different people perceive that randomness differently and how they deal with that. And then I became more interested in doing research in social cognitive processes behind the social, political and moral attitudes. One line of research I've done is about how abstract versus concrete thinking influence people's moral judgments and political judgments. And also in another line of research is about how analytic versus intuitive thinking is related to political attitudes, ideologies. And I have recently also started doing a lot of work in conspiracy theories. And part of it is because of the zeitgeist, COVID-19. But also, I became even more interested because I am living in Turkey. So I think one of my main points will be that. So because there are a lot of cross-cultural differences, and in certain countries, conspiracy theories sound more plausible, so to speak, because of the contextual details. And that's the kind of thing I'm looking into nowadays.
I don't want to get us on too much of a tangent, but you mentioned you've done some research with abstract versus more concrete thinking. I remember, at least it was a while back, I had started delving into maybe trying to figure out how do you go about like trying to examine that on I guess like maybe through either a survey or through some sort of experimental study. I've always been kind of stuck on thinking about how that could relate to something like a conspiracy theory, but trying to kind of pin down.
I'm not sure how it would relate to conspiracy theories, but what my research was mainly based on a theory called construal level theory. And, it's kind of based on the assumptions that people construe objects and events and everything, whether more abstract or more concrete ways. And usually you do that with manipulating how people, how people approach issues, whether on a very abstract level, like a higher order superordinate level, or more detailed, more concrete level, and how it influences them. One, for example, if I were to give an example, I have one publication about how when people are manipulated to think in a more abstract way, their responses to questionnaires measuring political attitudes like right-wing authoritarianism, social dominance orientation, etc., become more internally consistent when they think abstractly, because they are thinking about the more, you know, higher order factor of right-wing authoritarianism. So they give similar answers to different items of the same questionnaire. So one example would be that.
I dipped my toes into the conspiracy theory research, and that was a thought that came to mind. And the person I had talked to was a developmental psychologist, and they were like, we kind of look at this in kids. I don't know how we're really looking at it there, but I'm going to have to delve back into the literature on the construal theory. That might be the direction I need to go.
So one of the reasons why I wanted to have you on the podcast was kind of what you mentioned earlier, this cross-cultural contextual element to conspiracy theories. I guess from both your research and your experience being from Turkey, I feel like conspiracy research and probably research in general is very American-centric. So how do you approach conspiracy thinking, and what kind of contextual factors are you interested in accounting for within your research?
Yeah, so I mentioned being from Turkey, but actually it's not something very specific to Turkey, even to the United States, because you know, if we start from the very foundation, so and thinking about what is really a conspiracy, you could define it in very different ways. But you know, in simplest sense, you need to have a group of people coming together, making a plan, and that plan should be not very open, transparent. So it should be secretive, and they should be taking advantage of the situation while undermining everyone else's interest. So, but when you think about this way, when you really put it into words, then you also start realizing that these kind of things actually do happen sometimes. So it's not just fantasy. And some of the most famous examples of actual conspiracies, of course, it's not, you know, you could give an example from any other country, including Turkey, of course. But some of the most famous examples you also mentioned in the literature are from the United States. So one example is Project MKUltra. Maybe you heard. So it's for those who haven't heard. So it's like the CIA secret project, scientific project for using different drugs to control people's minds. So it's a mind control experiment. It sounds science fictional, but it did happen. Like, it was officially recognized that it did happen. But if I were to tell you that the government is trying to control people's minds, then it kind of sounds like a conspiracy, but it did happen at the same time. Or another one, a famous one, is the Tuskegee syphilis experiment. Again, happened in the United States, in Alabama. So basically starting around 1930s, the doctors started a new experiment to see the natural course of the disease of syphilis if you stop treating it. And they recruited a group of people. All of them are black males, and they just stopped treating them. But the problem was, the patients did not know that they were not being treated. They were actually under the impression that the drugs they are taking are real drugs, although all of them were placebo. So again, if I were to tell you that, you know, the government or the, you know, health system or the doctors intentionally do not treat certain group of people, it kind of sounds like a conspiracy and sounds ludicrous, but at the same time it did happen. Or in Turkey, for example, in like a few years ago, we had an attempted military coup in 2016, if I'm not mistaken. So it was basically organized by a religious cult, which was secretly organized within every kind of important official institution, including the army, the judicial system, et cetera, et cetera. So when they thought that they now have enough power, they started they attempted a military coup, although it failed. So, but if I were to tell you that a country is run by a secret cult, religious cult, it sounds crazy, but it did happen. So sometimes these kinds of things do happen, and they are more likely to happen in certain kinds of countries. Like, so my focus has been, of course, you could give any other example or any other concept or variable for this, I don't know, but my focus is mainly on corruption, level of corruption in a country. Because again, when you think about it, corruption is a kind of actual conspiracy, right? So a group of people coming together, usually doing a secret kind of arrangement deal and taking advantage while, you know, putting everyone else's interest at risk. So it's kind of a conspiracy against the people, in quotation marks. So I thought that, and so far the kind of evidence I've come across supports this. People in living in countries with higher corruption are more likely to believe in any kind of conspiracy theory. And my reasoning is that because it is indeed more likely that certain conspiracies might be happening in those countries. So they are not actually being completely irrational.
Could you operationalize corruption for me? So what are you looking at when, like, you have your list of countries in front of you in the data? What is the what's the data that stands out to you that you're like, oh, something's happening over here?
So I do not personally measure countries' corruption level, but, you know, there are certain indices measuring country level corruption, usually based on expert reports or other kinds of, you know, also there are other indices like rule of law, measuring countries, you know, judicial system, human rights, etc., etc. So there are already, you know, existing indices, and I've so far usually used those.
It's sort of the idea that if you already have a system that is, I guess, more open to letting some of these more corrupt actions or kind of loosening that rule of law, it's just a lot easier for people to get together and kind of do bad things, or to kind of skirt the system or abuse the system in ways. Not to keep throwing the US under the bus, but at the time of talking about this, that we're whole bunch of text messages have come out and been released to the public regarding the stuff that happened in January 6th, where it turns out there were a lot of people who were in the know. There were PowerPoint presentations going on to kind of talk about how to subvert US election law in order to keep the former president in power. And that is sort of this great idea, you know, or this great example, not a great idea, this great example of a actual conspiracy to an extent that was going on. And so if someone were to tell you that there were a bunch of government officials getting together and talking around, it's very easy for the people right now to be like, yeah, no, I can believe that. That makes complete sense to me. And then even if you disregarded everything from, you know, Tuskegee to MK Ultra to all the other stuff that we have these historic examples of.
And the problem is once you lose trust, both for people and institutions, you know, regardless, you become, you know, you just become ready to believe anything about, you know, they're doing something because you've already lost your trust. And that's one of the key findings in the literature on conspiracy beliefs. Actually, distrust, especially for institutions, are very central to conspiracy beliefs. And this distrust usually is based on some historical experience, like in our examples.
So have you found, because in your article from this year, actually, when you did the comparison between different countries on level of corruption and likelihood of conspiracy beliefs, where did you find the most conspiracy believers, I guess, centralized within these countries? Like, what was your descriptive findings of that research?
So, okay. So I don't know, you know, I don't know if I should name countries, but, you know, usually the main finding is the higher the corruption is. So obviously higher and lower corruption countries are kind of obvious, right? So more Western European, Scandinavian countries, etc., are, you know, usually the upper side, you know, they are better off about the issue of corruption, and also including like Australia, New Zealand, etc. And more Middle Eastern countries or South American countries, African countries, usually most of them, not all of them, but have lower scores or have higher levels of corruption based on these indices. And the more corruption in your country, the more you become, the more the people in those countries are. And the kind of, and the, in my paper, I think all of the, in, I report five studies, all of them are already, you know, on existing data sets. So I didn't collect the data myself. And all of them were national representative samples and large samples, like tens of thousands of people. And corruption is always, in all cases, positively related, meaning higher you have corruption, the more likely that you believe in any kind of conspiracy theory. But I think the most interesting finding is not that in that paper. The most important finding is that I also looked into how country-level corruption, and I named this, I don't know if it is the most appropriate way of calling this, but the kind of measures of individuals' gullibility, okay, to conspiracy theories, that there are a lot of different things, but, you know, we know that there are a lot of findings that education is important, analytical thinking ability is important, science literacy, scientific reasoning. So the more cognitively sophisticated you are, the less, you know, the less likely that you will believe in this conspiracy theory. So I try to see the interaction between this country level corruption and how cognitively, you know, in at an individual level, these people are cognitively sophisticated. So the interesting finding was that, let's say education, when education increases, conspiracy beliefs decreases, but this relationship was the strongest in low corruption countries only, usually. Okay, so when you increase the corruption level, you can increase, but I mean, like in countries with higher corruption, the relevance of your education level or your analytic thinking ability, etc., become less and less important in predicting conspiracy theories. Of course, you could interpret this in any way, because, you know, this is just a finding and you make a subjective interpretation of this. But my interpretation is that it's because in low corruption countries, conspiracy theories are less plausible compared to high corruption countries. That's why education or analytic thinking ability is important. But in higher corruption countries, it is more plausible, and it actually starts sounding more reasonable. That's why the relationship with education, etc., become less and less important in those contexts.
Education ties into something I'm thinking, that we have these possible like other social factors. So education could be one of them, where maybe more corrupt countries, less money is being put towards education. And so maybe there is some other underlying factor that might, you know, kind of change high versus low educated individuals. But do you think there may be, I guess, maybe other factors, you know, kind of similar to that, social factors that may be more likely to show up in some of these, I guess, more corrupt versus those less corrupt countries?
Yeah. So in my analysis, I also looked into how corruption predicts conspiracy beliefs, controlling for some other cross-country differences. Okay. So there was some mixed evidence, but the meta-analysis of all studies, okay, showed that, and because the mixed finding is because you have like a low sample size, because of your sample is the number of countries, so you can't have like thousands of countries. But when you meta-analyze the all the studies, what I found that this relationship between corruption and conspiracy beliefs is significant even after controlling for differences in GDP, for example. And PISA scores, PISA is the, I don't know, probably you've heard, you know, but, you know, the international exam for the high school students and comparing their performance in mathematics, readings, and science. So it's like a standardized test, a universal test comparing different countries, how well they are, you know. So PISA score, and also some cross-cultural differences that are shown to be related to conspiracy theories, like individualism, collectivism, power distance, masculinity, and uncertainty avoidance. So controlling for all of this, corruption was still a significant predictor of conspiracy beliefs.
So conspiracy beliefs are almost diagnostic of the health of a country, and broadly then.
Some of the other guests that we've talked to about this, we've kind of talked about kind of the nature of sort of what drives people. And so part of it is things like media exposure. So again, if you understand that history, it kind of makes sense that it's going to seem a little more plausible. Or if the media is covering a particular event, you're going to be far more aware of this, whether it's a viable theory or not, or a viable event or not. But I guess sort of one of the things that kind of keeps coming up is there does at least seem to be, I guess, at least in the United States, that with our discussions is kind of almost baseline. Like there's this particular almost set number of individuals who tend to believe a particular conspiracy theory. And then we kind of see this going back to even like the JFK assassination. So stuff that we don't have any actual evidence of maybe a broader conspiracy going on, but there's always kind of a group of people. While it kind of doesn't seem that your research would kind of note maybe a similar thing, like from a historical perspective, that what you are seeing though is, while there may be maybe a baseline of people who might believe in more, I guess, implausible or maybe plausible but not really confirmed conspiracy theories, there's at least an increase in maybe a willingness to accept, which I don't know if I'm kind of wording this as well as I could, but trying to, I guess, trying to parse out some of the differences between some individuals who might be a little more predisposed to where we would see more kind of widespread acceptance within these countries. And I mean, what it sounds like is your research is kind of getting at that it's almost like the plausibility goes up, or at least your ability to identify and go, yeah, well, that's just how the government works here, or that's how things have always been my entire life. That there's almost like a level of the word I'm thinking of is like learned helplessness, where it's sort of like, well, I can't do anything about it, but there's all these conspiracies going on.
Yeah, so of course, you know, no one can deny that there's important like individual differences. So some people have what they call as a conspiracy mindset, so they are kind of more prone to these kinds of beliefs. And it is also the fact that you know, a small minority of people could be very loud about conspiracy theories, and that might lead us to kind of overestimate the number of conspiracy believers. Because there's one study, for example, showing that, like, if I'm not mistaken, like 60 or even maybe more, 60% of all misinformation about COVID-19 vaccines are created by only 12 people around the world. So it's almost like, a real conspiracy, like 12 people coming together and doing all the misinformation. So yeah, there's important differences. And also, I think, you know, having said that, we shouldn't also be very sure about whether there's a rise in conspiracy beliefs over time. Because one study, they looked into the letters addressed at the editors of New York Times, and the other one, I think, I could be wrong, but I think Chicago Tribune, for over 100 years. And they tried to spot like things that are related to conspiracy theories, like conspiracy silent kind of thing. And they didn't find any historical trends. Like it wasn't increasing or decreasing. So it was like a stable level. So of course, I'm not sure about the situation in the United States, but in Turkey, we now have a lot of COVID-19 conspiracy theories. But before that, we had some different kinds of conspiracy theories. So it just changes shape. So we shouldn't also be very, very sure about whether there's a rise or decrease, or whether how many people are actually over there, strong believers of the conspiracy theories.
Kind of a theme of what we've been seeing in a lot of our discussions on this is that we recently talked to Dr. Uzinski and Dr. Enders, political scientists who kind of research this, and they kind of look at both the political spectrum, which I think would probably be far more salient within like a corruption level in terms of countries, where you have obviously like the party I'm against, they're behind some stuff. The party I'm for, maybe they're not as much. It's easier to see those kind of conspiracy theories, and they're more common amongst the kind of the average person. And there's a distinction between that and then sort of your more non-normative conspiracy theories. So conspiracy theories that involve much more like antisocial tendencies behind them. And we kind of see that as well with a lot of the stuff here with like QAnon, where the data doesn't really show that they've gotten any more support, but they have gotten more Twitter time and more media time. And that does create this kind of perception that they're maybe bigger than they actually are. And maybe they are really big in certain spheres, but it's kind of difficult. Like COVID-19 conspiracy theories are a really good example with those 12 people. And they're a small group of people, and they're kind of niche. I followed a couple of them in terms of trying to understand like some of the anti-vax conspiracies that they're very niche, and they're within that same mindset, but they're very loud and they're very well-funded in a sense.
So one of the articles that you sent to us related to precarity in conspiracy theories, and so this idea that you're just like hanging on for dear life in terms of like economics or safety or food, shelter, things like that. One of the things that I've noticed is that precarity seems to be increasing, and this may just be within the American context of the gig economy, like post economic collapse. Could you speak to like the relationship between precarity and corruption and with conspiracy theories?
Yeah, of course, they're not the same thing, but I think it kind of fits into my overall argument. That's why actually I kind of included the article, because precarity is, as you said, you know, a kind of permanent, continuous sense of insecurity about your employment, your job. And this creates a sense of insecurity, okay, and also inequality, because you think that you're not being treated fairly, you're not getting what you deserve. So this actually, in that paper, this reduces the trust in the system, in the institutions, because you think that the political or economic system is organized in a way that continues to put you at a disadvantage and not treating you fairly. So you don't trust the system. And that decrease in trust in return lead to higher conspiracy beliefs, because, you know, if you don't believe in the official narratives of the institutions, you are like one inch away from, you know, going down the rabbit hole of the conspiracy theories, because you are now ready to believe in anything. Of course, I'm not saying that we should always believe in the official narrative. Obviously, that's my point, because sometimes they are lying, you know, in certain contexts. But that also increases the risk, because now you're looking at other sources of information and alternative sources, and it increases the risk that you will come across with these conspiracy theories. Mm-hmm.
So it's almost in certain circumstances, particularly with precarity, it is reasonable to have a turn to conspiracy theories in that case. It's not as pathological as we tend to talk about it.
Yeah, because you know, when you think about precarity, it's like, why, you know, you being insecure about your job, does it somehow provide an advantage to someone else? It does. It does provide an advantage to your employer, for example, because, you know, now your employer have more control over you because you're less secure, so you have to do whatever they want, etc. So it is kind of creating a difference in power, or increasing the difference in power, which is kind of almost sound like a conspiracy that the whole system is organized in this way.
Definitely see that in the United States on like the political sphere, that the concept of like identity politics works off of this. If you can build that insecurity, and I mean, you could probably find great examples across the spectrum and countries across the world of this idea of creating kind of that us versus them. There are these people out there, they're keeping you down, and I mean, even like the broader, you know, the big conspiracy theories that we tend to see kind of transcend. So like this idea of a secret cabal of individuals, or like a one world government or something like that, is again, this us versus them, that I don't have that control. I'm struggling to make it through, and I kind of need to put a face to that. It can't just be like the entire system, because that would cause even more anxiety. And so maybe it's you know, kind of latching on to a specific group of people or a specific individual in some cases.
Yeah, when you put a name and face, also you kind of think that you have some sort of control over the situation, as you said, because you know the enemy and you're prepared. And there's also another line of research on conspiracy theories that are onto this, like feeling of control, feeling secure about yourself. So when you, for example, you believe that COVID-19 vaccines are dangerous for your health, or it includes microchips or whatever, that belief ironically increases your sense of safety, right? Because while all the other guys are taking this dangerous thing, you are better off. So you are ready for the post-apocalyptic world, and they will all die, kind of thing. So so it kind of gives you a false sense of security when you put a name and face on
that. It makes sense too why like certain prominent individuals are usually targeted with that. And so you look at like Bill Gates is a big target right now for COVID-19 stuff. And I mean, we're talking about political sense. There's usually a face or a person. It's not... And usually it's more complicated than that, but to gain that sense of control, or that so some of the stuff that we see with conspiracy theory is that idea of having that kind of secret information, of being in the know, and so that makes sense that it would give you some sense of control. You at least feel that you have control because you can at least be aware of it.
One of our primary audience that we kind of like speak to on this podcast is undergraduate psychology students. And so if they wanted to, say, go to graduate school and pursue this relationship between corruption, economic inequality, and conspiracy beliefs, what do you think those dissertations will look like in 5 years?
I don't know. I think like there is a lack of research about, you know, how when you manipulate actually kind of experimentally people's sense of security, you know, a lot of this, you know, conspiracy psychological literature on conspiracy theories is about usually correlational studies. And, you know, so we are kind of far away from establishing any cause and effect relationship and being confident about that. I think there's an important lack of studies looking into those kinds of, you know, doing you know, manipulating people's sense of security or perception of inequality, perception of corruption, and see how it works for them. And also I think, you know, this is not directly related to the papers that I mentioned, but in general in conspiracy theories literature, there is also a very important lack of how you should talk to conspiracy believers. So there are a lot of speculation based on certain kind of findings, but there's very few, if any, studies directly looking into hardcore conspiracy theories and whether there is any way, in any way, how we could like do an intervention or kind of thing. So because, you know, the public is actually interested in that. You know, if you as a social psychologist mention that you study conspiracy theories, one of the first questions they will ask, you know, how can we convince these people? But we are very far away from answering that question, I think. There are, of course, some strong arguments, but we still need a lot of work.
I only know of one study that looked, and I remember hearing about it years ago on kind of a radio podcast, was on particular parents who are anti-vaxxers. And it was very specific to those particular individuals who had concerns about their kids. And they found that, you know, if you address the fear first, but that may not work for the person who's believing that aliens have, you know, taken over the government, or that lizard people are there, or that, you know, even if we take something a little less, you know, out there, that it would have to be. And that's a good point to bring up, that we need more, because we would need a lot of little specific ones.
Yeah, but also at the same time, we shouldn't really kind of separate different kinds of, you know, of course there are different types of conspiracy theories, but they are all somehow interrelated with each other as well. You know, for example, if you ask different kinds of conspiracy theories, like assassination of JFK, Princess Diana, you know, QAnon, et cetera, usually, you know, it is considered as like one factor scale, because it's very internally consistent. So you can't even separate them. You just take a mean score out of everything in usually a lot of studies. So, and there are also studies showing that once you believe in conspiracy theory X, you automatically become more likely to believe in the other ones as well, even when they are mutually exclusive. So maybe, I don't know if you've mentioned in the other episodes, but one interesting study, for example, showed that there is a positive correlation between the conspiracy theory that Princess Diana was actually assassinated versus Princess Diana is not actually dead and still living somewhere far away. So these are kind of, it's impossible for both of them to be true at the same time, right? Because you cannot be dead and alive at the same time. But there's a positive correlation between the two, even for mutually exclusive conspiracy theories. For the other ones, obviously there are positive correlations. So we shouldn't, I think, kind of go one by one for conspiracy theories. It's more about a mentality issue, which leads to all sorts of conspiracy theories.
So getting down to kind of the nature of the belief itself and kind of what maybe predisposes, and seeing if we can work on some sort of inoculation or some sort of resistance to that. Yeah, that's fascinating.
So this is also kind of my point, because, you know, why do people believe in any conspiracy theory? Because they don't believe in the official explanation of that event, okay? So they look for some alternative explanations. So it means that it is a sign that you have deep distrust of the institutions, of the experts in the area, etc. You don't trust them. So if you don't trust them, you don't trust them for other issues as well. So it's kind of, I think, very obvious that you would be more likely to believe any conspiracy theory, regardless of the content, because you don't believe in what you're reading on the newspaper. You always look for some alternative explanation.
And on the other hand, it may be beyond inoculation, like you said, with relationship to corruption, like conspiracy theories, say, in South America, for example. I mean, they have a very good reason to be conspiratorial after all of the stuff that the United States has done to their democracies, right? So it's maybe not even a pathological response. It's probably fairly reasonable.
Yeah, it is, you know, It is, as you said, I think relatively more reasonable or plausible, even if it is not correct. It sounds relatively more rational. But at the same time, I should stress that, you know, I am not saying that we cannot do anything on a personal level. I'm not saying that, because there are also important interpersonal differences as well. For example, Turkey, okay, has higher conspiracy beliefs, according to the studies I reported, compared to many other countries. Not the highest, but, you know, one of the highest. But I don't believe personally in any of those conspiracy theories. And there are a lot of people, maybe more than half of the population, you probably, you know, the majority does not believe. So it doesn't mean that we are kind of doomed. We are kind of destined to believe in conspiracy theories just because we are living in a certain context. But it kind of relatively increases the risk. That's my point. Mm-hmm. So inoculation, for example, for conspiracy theories, I think would work in any country, but the strength of its effect might vary, maybe.
Mm-hmm. No, that makes sense.
Yeah, that definitely does, especially in relation to like those other issues, plausibility, trust in the system, which is it's very fascinating, but also makes sense in the realm of someone saying like, I think that Princess Diana was assassinated, but also she's still alive somewhere, is sort of like a ad hoc hypothesis build up of that. When someone presents them with the evidence that she wasn't assassinated, they're like, well, she must be alive. We have a lot of issues with like the JFK assassination and 9/11 conspiracy theories and things like that, where a lot of the individuals who are hardcore conspiracy theorists about this, they're basing all their evidence off of the government reports. So on one hand, they're saying they don't trust the government, but their evidence is coming directly from the government. There's this kind of weird disconnect that's built off that combination, that maybe they don't trust some of it, but that distrust is there. You're typically going to see that distrust in someone who's going to, you know, hold those more government oriented conspiracy theories.
Is there anything coming down the pipe for you right now?
Well, yeah. There's, you know, we actually have another paper preprint, which is on the peer review right now. So we looked into, together with Karen Douglas, which is a very prominent figure in conspiracy theory, and Valeria Capraro, we looked into how conspiracy theories relate to generosity, prosocial behavior. And again, it's similarly, it's based on an existing data set of more than 40,000 people from, I think, 52 countries. And so the way they measured generosity is how willing people are to donate money to charities which are trying to protect people from COVID-19. Okay, so they said, if we were to give you this amount of money, what percentage would you donate? So what we found is, I think, as expected, that higher conspiracy, you know, when people have more conspiracy beliefs, they become less likely to donate to charities. But, you know, this is kind of expected, but I think more interesting thing, and it also is very closely linked to everything else I've discussed, is that they were, you know, there were two different questions, how much you would donate to a national charity and how much you would donate to international charity. So our expectation actually was that they would be less likely, conspiracy believers would be less likely to donate international charities, because it's like an alt group, you know, who are, you know, doing whatever they want, etc. So trying to undermine you. But the findings showed exactly the opposite, and people were less likely to donate to national charities compared to international charities. And this, again, we tried to understand why this would be the case in more exploratory analysis. And we, again, decided to insert corruption level of the country into the analysis. So we saw that this this phenomenon is stronger in countries with high levels of corruption. So people do not trust national charities. They even sometimes, they even trust international charities more than the national ones. And this phenomenon is stronger and sometimes only significant in high corruption countries. So basically, if you're living in a high corruption country, you don't believe the people in your country and other people. And again, you could make the same argument here, because if you are living in a high corruption country, you have no trust for the institution, for the judicial system, et cetera, et cetera. If you're living in a very high corruption country, when you donate money, you have no idea where that money actually goes to. Okay, so there are all sorts of things happening. So it kind of, when you think about it in that way, it kind of makes sense that people have less trust in national charities because they are living in a very high corruption country. And I think that's also another additional piece of evidence how this country level context is important in understanding conspiracy beliefs.
So corruption can even dismantle your own in-group. It sounds like that you would see that deviation from that like theoretical expectation of in-group, yeah. Out-group. That's crazy.
You know, for example, it makes sense to me because, you know, when I think about it, for example, I think a lot of people would be more confident in Turkey, let's say, and you could do a similar argument in many other countries. People would be more confident in donating money to, a Swedish charity compared to a Turkish one, because they would be more confident that that money will be taken, you know, will go to the intended places, etc. So again, it kind of makes sense to me, and because sometimes this deep distrust and even sometimes conspiracy theories, because they kind of sometimes make relatively more sense in certain cultural contexts. That's one of the reasons why I became interested in this line of research. Actually,
it's now making me think of like how some of the stuff would play out like state to state. So I'm originally from Louisiana, a southern state with a long history of corrupt government. We've got governors who have gone to prison for years and lots of issues. And I remember coming to the state I'm in now, and they're like, we have this one person, you know, who went to jail for doing something. And I was like, it's nothing compared to what our former governor did. And like that amount of trust in the government, I think, would be very apt if I compared even just state to state, much like we could compare country to country, that I would, you know, would not be surprised to see a lot of this stuff. And then to see like, I think those things like trust as an underlying motive. So that's fascinating.
Trust, you know, the kind of common sense knowledge, and also kind of, I think also psychological almost fact, is trust is very easy. Something it's very easy to lose, right? It's hard to earn. But you know, because we are kind of negatively biased, we usually place more importance for negative things. Maybe a person tells us 100 truths, but if he just tells one lie, that's it. So we give like disproportionate weight to that. So this is something. Especially during the COVID-19, this is something ignored, you know, because sometimes, for example, health institutions, experts, doctors, etc., they did not probably lie intentionally, but with limited data, with limited knowledge, they sometimes make very broad generalizations, which turn out to be incorrect in a few months, for example, you know. That kind of strategy is very wrong, right? Because you lose trust, and once you lose that, actually people start believing all sorts of other things, you know, even the most ridiculous conspiracy theories, because now they are not listening to you. They are no longer listening to you, and they are listening to someone else. And so I think especially institutions and people of power or reputation or expertise should be very careful about that.
The last year or so has been marked by carelessness. And so I fully understand why there is hesitancy and conspiracy theories. Absolutely.
I think we see that with like social psychology dealing with our replication, you know, the replication crisis and things like that, is that it's really easy to pick up on like those issues, and it makes it really tough to be like no, like we're doing good work. It's just, it takes time and replication, and there are issues that need to be fixed, and it makes me understand completely why someone would be like, oh, you're a social psychologist, I see.
Yeah, exactly. So for example, I use Twitter very actively, although I usually write in Turkish, and I have like around 28,000 followers. And most of the time, not always, but I share social psychological findings in a way that everyone would understand in a very simple terms. And one of the common responses I get, especially if people are familiar with this replication crisis, etc. So you're a social psychologist, what do you know? You know, this another social psychologist coming, you know, these are just, you know, nonsense, bullshit, etc. So once you lose that trust, as you said, you know, it becomes very difficult to regain it.
It might be why we're seeing too a lot of that mistrust in science that's kind of profound in a lot of countries. It's just because we're more exposed to it than ever. And so we're not just exposed to all the good findings, but we're also exposed to all the bad findings. And unless you kind of are able to parse that out, maybe understand it, you know, and again, you don't get that opportunity if you're just on Twitter every now and then you got to go back to your 10-hour-a-day job. It's easy to just be like, these people again, we're going to find out, you know, in 6 months that this thing's completely different than we thought it was. When that's just sort of the nature of what we do.
There is a fatigue that's like the chocolate fatigue, where like every 6 months the news will tell you that chocolate's either the best thing in the world or the worst thing in the world for you. So like, we're all tired of it.
Yeah, I guess that's everything we've gotten. And thank you again for coming on and sharing your research with us. And especially the up and coming stuff to kind of add to, you know, fresh off, you know, almost off the presses.
You're welcome.
Research. It's really, really fascinating to get into this at kind of the country level, or, you know, looking at this on a broader scale than just sort of, why is this person thinking this way, as opposed to, you know, in these broader senses of why larger groups are what might be influencing, you know, the kind of underlying belief in some of these conspiracies.
Thank you. It was a very great conversation. I hope you enjoyed it as well. And we will need a lot of these kinds of studies, not only on conspiracy theories, but also closely related things like pseudoscience beliefs and paranormal beliefs, etc., which are also likely to become societal problems. And also, we shouldn't forget that we've had a lot of difficulty with COVID-19 pandemic, but we have a bigger crisis coming, which is called climate change. And it is already started leading to all sorts of conspiracy theories. It will probably become even a bigger problem. So it's not just like an intellectual game in understanding conspiracy theories, but these things have real effects on life. So we need to do a lot of more research on this.
And we'll put the links to the articles that you sent and so the stuff that we've talked about in the description here, and definitely keep this conversation going. Just, again, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for coming on. Good luck with your peer review. I'm excited to see your article when it comes out.
Thank you. Thanks for inviting.
Hello, everyone. Welcome back.
We're back.
Post-recording. Much like our last episode, to talk about the bias of the week.
Huzzah!
And so, I don't know. I felt it difficult after our conversation with Dr. Alper that I don't really think this plays out, but it should be something related to someone with maybe a high conspiracy mindset.
Mm-hmm.
Or if you already have, let's say, a corrupt government, it's maybe a little easier to build this particular bias into some other unrelated thing. And with that, our bias of the week comes from Chapman and Chapman, 1967, the illusory correlation. So inaccurately perceiving a relationship between two unrelated events.
So like Princess Diana was assassinated and Princess Diana's in hiding.
I mean, in that case, there's an actual correlation. There's data to suggest that there is a correlation between people.
Well, across people who believe those things.
Right.
But if you have both of them in your head, it's like Schrodinger's Diana.
Right. No, I mean, this would be something like, I think the example that's typically used in a lot of the research would be something like, all you see are, I'm trying to word this well. I'll use an example of, let's say, growing up watching the news from New Orleans. Mm-hmm. Wake up every morning, we watch the news, and they're talking about a shooting.
Right.
And so when we actually look at crime statistics, people are far less likely to be shot than they were 20 years ago, 30 years ago. Mm-hmm. Crime is at a all-time low in comparison, again, to, let's say, like the 70s and 80s, where it was at an all-time high. But if you're turning on the news every morning and all you're being exposed to is crime, that there's this association that you're in a very crime-ridden environment. Or if all you're given is kind of one narrative, and those things might be unrelated. The area has nothing to do with the crime. There are other factors that are causing the crime.
Right.
Or if the only crime that is reported is about a particular group of people, if we're talking about, you know, New Orleans' Ninth Ward,
mm-hmm.
It again builds this relationship up when it's more about the environment than it is the people in it. Mm-hmm. And so it seems that there's this relationship there, but there's not actually a strong relationship between one and the other.
Right. And so you could extend that to conspiracy thinking in that you have a bunch of loose correlations that may or may not exist that holds this belief system together.
I mean, in the same way, if you already think that there's a secret one world Illuminati government, every little thing that pops up is probably going to be related to that, even though those two things are not related. Sometimes it's just your local government.
Right.
We're talking about corruption. So, yeah. So I don't know. It doesn't necessarily like fit entirely into the discussion that we just had, but but it is definitely tied to some sort of some conspiracy theory mindsets. We're all kind of victim of this, and I think a lot of it is tied to like misinformation or limited information. You know, again, if you don't have the whole story or you're dealing with very anecdotal level stuff, you've only got one or two examples. You know, if every psychologist you meet has some sort of psychological issue, you're probably gonna say, well, all these psychologists have something wrong with them. I always used to joke, I knew a couple of psychologists who were married, and the marriage did not work out, and so I had this like perception that like I could never date a psychologist.
Mm-hmm.
It just would not work. But also it does work plenty. Like it has nothing to do with the psychology. It has everything to do with the people.
Right. Because I think all of my psychologist friends who are married to psychologists, they're doing fantastic.
Yeah. No, this was that specific situation that kind of painted it. Or, you know, again, maybe running into that one student from that one group who starts shaping like the class that semester, and you're like, all these students from this group. It's that person.
Mm-hmm.
It's not this broader relationship. These are unrelated events. There's something else going on that leads to that behavior, or something else that's going on behind it, or behind the scenes or something.
Right.
So this has been a good discussion week.
It has been a good discussion. Yeah. So for our listeners, we tried something new this week, and we did all of our interviews in the same week, and we're going to release them over time.
We'll never do it again.
We'll never do this again. Because by the time this airs in like mid-January, we've already had this discussion for a month at this point. So It has been great. We've been living in conspiracy world for a week straight.
A week now, almost.
Yeah, almost a week. It's been fun. I've learned a lot.
Yeah, definitely. And then I think we'll come back next episode and we'll do a bit of like a recap and retrospect. Maybe we'll let it percolate for a couple of
weeks.
And then come back to it and share our own thoughts.
Mm-hmm. Do a little debrief.
Yeah. So
cool. Well, I look forward to that.
I do too. And with that, again, we will bid everyone farewell.
Goodbye.